This is Dr. Wally B. from Cat Daddy in the 1320s, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn, making waves.
Packers.
Vikings.
Red State.
Blue State.
We come from different places.
Uptown.
Downtown.
We come to different conclusions.
Half empty.
Half full.
But no matter how different we are, we're all connected, and we can all make a difference. That's why United Way brings people, expertise, and resources together to improve the education, income, and health of our communities, the building blocks for a better life. When we live united, our efforts, magnified by others, add up to real change. Children succeed in school, families gain financial stability, the health of our neighbors improves, and suddenly, so do our communities. But real change won't happen without you.
Live united.
So let's look beyond our differences.
Live united.
One by one, let's make a difference. Let's reach out a hand to one and influence the condition of all.
Live united.
Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Sign up today at liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
The healthcare industry will continue to be one of the largest employers of college graduates. More jobs are expected to be with nursing than any other occupation. Are you ready to make a difference in the world? Are you looking for an education and career that has advancement? Right now, there is a high demand for nurses, both male and female. Breaking into the nursing career means getting an education. Henry Ford Community College offers an associate's degree in the nursing program. All graduates can acquire full-time employment upon passing the licensing examination for registered nurses. For more information, please call 313-845-6300. Once again, that's 313-845-6300. Or look us up on the web at hfcc.edu. Henry Ford Community College. The right education, right now.
Arthur C. Clarke once observed, two possibilities exist. Either we are alone in the universe, or we are not. Both are equally terrifying. Join your host, David Twitchell, the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m., when he and special guests examine the scientific evidence on We Are Not Alone. Right here on WHFR. FM 89.3. That's the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. We are not alone.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by LegalZoom. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but has been dedicated to the legal needs of individuals, families, and small businesses for more than 12 years. Providing online self-help services at users' specific direction. Use the code FREAK for a special offer available to Freakonomics listeners.
I think, 50 years from now, and people look back on New York and, of course, other cities, that they'll say, what did these people think they were doing?
That's Donald Shoup. He is a college professor at UCLA who is obsessed... Well, it's not really fair to call him obsessed. Who is... Yeah, actually, he is obsessed. He's obsessed with this one thing that we all do all over the world, and that we do so badly, in Shoup's opinion, that someday we'll look back at it the way we now look back at...
Bloodletting.
Seriously? Bloodletting?
It seemed scientific because there were elaborate tables and diagrams, and it had to be done by surgeons and stuff. It was very harmful. The other comparison, which I think is much more appropriate, is lead therapy. Lead was thought to be a wonderful healing device, and it is, because it's toxic to microorganisms, and therefore if you put it on a wound, it would help kill the infection. But people didn't know that it also damaged the brain.
Okay. So what do you think Professor Shoup is talking about? What is this thing we do so badly that future generations will compare it to bloodletting and lead therapy?
Maybe the most mismanaged of all our resources is parking.
Parking?
It's terrible. It's really terrible.
It's crazy. It's horrible. It's way out of hand.
I've driven around for an hour looking for a spot.
Most people don't know what they're doing, and I really want to like go out there and be like, I will park your car for you.
Yeah, it's a total nightmare.
Yeah. Parking.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
If I asked you to name the worst things about modern society, maybe the 10 worst things, I'm guessing that parking would not make your list, might not even make a top 20 list. And yet, especially if you live or work in a city, you've probably been scarred at some point by parking.
I used to park on the sidewalk and get tickets, but there was sort of no other place to go.
Everybody has stories of parking horror that we don't have about stories about horror at grocery stores or with milk or anything else. And they had stories about, you know, even murders over parking spaces.
That's Donald Shoup again from UCLA. He is a transportation scholar who is one of the world's leading authorities on parking. Now, you might think that any right-thinking transportation scholar would study, you know, transport. But as Shoup helpfully points out, the average car spends about 95% of its lifetime parked. Shoup trained as an economist, and his economist roots often show when he talks about parking, because in his view, the biggest problem with parking is the price. Not too expensive, too cheap. He is the author of a nearly 800-page book called The High Cost of Free Parking.
Everybody likes free parking, including me, and probably you. But just because the driver doesn't pay for it doesn't mean that the cost goes away. If you don't pay for parking your car, somebody else has to pay for it, and that somebody is everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We pay for free parking and the prices of the goods we buy at places where the parking is free, and we pay for parking as residents when we get free parking with our housing. We pay for it as taxpayers, and increasingly I think we're paying for it in terms of the environmental harm that it causes. I did use data to estimate that parking subsidies in the United States are somewhere between 1 and 4% of the total GNP, which is about what we in the range of what we spend for Medicare or national defense.
Mm.
So that's the cost of parking not paid for by drivers.
There are, of course, many different parking scenarios. If you live in a house with a driveway or a garage, parking is a snap, at least when you're at home. In suburban or exurban areas, you've got big, usually free parking lots set back from the street at office parks and malls and restaurants. And then you've got cities, some of which offer free parking right there on the street, curbside. But here's Donald Shoup again to explain why that free parking isn't as free as you think.
If you don't have an off-street space and you have a car and you live in New York, you have to drive around looking for a space, hoping to see somebody going out. There was a study done in New York, a very ingenious method, though simple in retrospect, is that the researchers interviewed drivers who were stopped at traffic lights in Manhattan and Brooklyn and asked them if they were cruising for parking. And on Prince Street in Manhattan, 28% of the drivers said that they were hunting for parking, even though most people were not destined for the area. They were just traveling through the area. So those are people who don't want to be driving. They want to be parked. We did a study here in Los Angeles, lasting a full year, cruising for parking ourselves, going to a destination and then hunting for as long as it took to find a parking space. We made 240 observations. When you add it up, the average time it took to space was only 3 minutes. That's 2.5 times around the block, which doesn't seem like very much. It's about a half a mile.
hunting for a parking. But when you add up all the people who are parking in Westwood Village, if they had the same average that we had, that adds up to 3,600 vehicle miles of travel a day. That's the distance across the U.S., and it's just in a 15-block area of Westwood. If you add it up for a year, that's equal to 36 trips around the Earth or 4 trips to the moon, hunting for underpriced curb parking at a little 15-block area. And I think it's happening all over the world. And when other people do these studies, they find very similar results.
I'm just curious, when we talk about urban and suburban sprawl that many people hate, I think, you know, the common image is you're cruising down that street that has a lot of stoplights because there are a lot of turns. There are a lot of turns because there are a lot of shops. There are a lot of shops, and they all have big parking lots. And that whole chain reaction causes a lot of congestion, confusion, accidents, pollution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When you think of that scenario, how much of that scenario do you think of as caused by the ancient practice of offering free parking everywhere you go?
Well, it isn't ancient. It was
ancient. I mean, 1950s or 1960s. You know, when,
that's right. Yeah, city planners in every city, including large parts of New York, specify the minimum number of parking spaces required for every building, depending on its use. You know, a restaurant typically requires at least 10 spaces per 1,000 square feet, which means the parking lot's 3 times bigger than the restaurant. And if nothing can be built unless it meets that parking requirement, and the parking requirement was established on the assumption that everybody's going to park free, well, it does seem to be kind of self-fulfilling that people drive to it.
Every city has its own parking requirements, but here's a typical scenario. To build a shopping center, you need 4 spaces for every 1,000 square feet of store. A public swimming pool requires 1 parking space for every 2,500 gallons of water. If you want to build a beauty shop, you need 3 spaces per beautician. But a nunnery needs only 1 space per 10 nuns.
The required parking spreads buildings apart, and it makes walking less pleasant. You know, the obvious way to travel is that, you know, we curse traffic and stare at taillights and breathe fumes, and then we expect to park free when we get there. But I think the upside of the mess that we're in is a terrific opportunity that there's all this vacant land that can be built on in cities. I mean, I think we're the Saudi Arabia of developable land in cities. If cities reduced, eliminated their minimum parking requirements, a lot of these parking lots could be built on for infill development.
So as Shoup points out, there are 2 distinct parking problems. In the suburbs, too much land goes to parking because of somewhat arbitrary requirements, and then those areas become harder to navigate and walk in. And in cities, a lot of street parking is either free or underpriced, which leads to too many drivers cruising for spots. This creates even more congestion, pollution, and accident risk.
I think the world would be a lot better if we had never forced people to provide more parking than they're willing to, and if we had charged the right price for curb parking. What is the right price for curb parking? I would say that this is what's been adopted in more and more cities, is that the right price is the lowest price the city can charge and leave 1 or 2 vacant spaces on every block so that nobody can say it's hard to find a space, because wherever they go, they see a space.
That makes sense, doesn't it? At least to an economist. If you're selling something and so many people are trying to buy it that it makes a mess for everyone, you are plainly charging too little. So how do you fix that? Later in the program, we will hear how Donald Shoup and others are trying. But before we go micro, let's go macro. Let's get a sense of just how much parking we're talking about in a country as big as the United States.
There's some cities that the ratio of surface parking is very high. Houston, for example, sometimes could be 30 to 35% of the overall area.
30 to 35% of Houston is surface parking lot?
Of some areas, yes.
Aran Ben-Joseph teaches urban studies and planning at MIT. He, too, has written a book about parking called Rethinking a Lot, The Design and Culture of Parking. While Donald Shoup is the godfather of parking studies, Ben-Joseph is one of a growing number of what some people call Shoupistas. Ben-Joseph is an Israeli. He's lived and worked all over the world.
In the United States, the first thing that you experience, I think, as somebody who come from a smaller country that is much denser, is the amount of open space, the lower density, and in a way, to some extent, the ample supply of available land is something striking. In that sense, the dependency on the car and the lack of, to some extent, public transportation in some parts of the U.S. versus other countries, and those that I experience firsthand, such as Japan, Israel, and Europe, are very different.
I think if you ask most people what they think about parking, most people think or would say there's not enough parking. For starters, do we know or do you know how many parking spaces there actually are in America, let's say?
So, yeah, we tried to calculate that, and my interest was mainly on surface parking lot, which are, I guess, the lowest on the kind of evolution chain, if you will, of parking. Surface lots are the most mundane, cheapest type of parking that you can construct. We don't have a very good estimate. They run all over the map, but I think the best guess that I could give you is that there are about 3 parking spaces for every car in the United States.
Wow.
So, and so that's for the whole country, of course.
And is that including?
And that's only for passenger cars, right?
Oh, my
gosh. So if we have 250 million cars in the United States, passenger cars, and you multiply that by about the average of 3. Now, of course, you know, people in New York will tell you or somewhere, well, there's no way there are 3 parking spaces. But, of course, you have to look at it, you know, with regard to the whole country. So that brings it to almost 800 million spaces.
Again, is that just surface lots, as you said? Or
those are just surface lots.
And then, in addition to surface lots, there are
you have garages, of course.
Okay.
You have people's own parking spaces in their homes.
Driveways, yeah.
Driveways, garages. I'm talking about public spaces or private spaces that are surface lots, not structured.
And it may be hard to estimate, but what share of total parking spaces would you say that these surface lots constitute?
You know, that's a good one. I think that there's somewhere between, they say, around 70%, 60 to 70%.
Okay, so if you're saying that these surface lots constitute maybe 60 or 70% of the overall parking supply in the U.S., and then if we were to add in, let's say, the rest of that 30 or 40%, we might get to a figure where there are roughly 4 or 4.5 parking spots in America for every car.
Yeah, and some people even claim that there are 8.
So how can we possibly complain that there's
Well, this is exactly as you said. There's a wonderful quote from somebody who, I can't remember where it was, who calculated that in that particular city there were almost 8 spaces per car, and then he published it, and I think that people complain that, you know, I still can never find parking. So where are all these, you know, 8 spaces for my car?
In case you couldn't tell, Aran Ben-Joseph doesn't like all those surface lots. And not just because of the sprawl. Environmentally, paving over huge swaths of land isn't a very good idea. So, how to do better? Ben-Joseph has some thoughts. At the very least, you could break up huge lots with trees and vegetation. Paint the parking lots light colors so they don't absorb so much heat. Use permeable paving materials to cut down on runoff. Now, to be honest, a lot of academics have neat ideas that they think will fix the world. And most of the time, no one pays attention to them. But a few years ago, something strange and potentially wonderful happened in the realm of parking. Some transportation officials in San Francisco who had read Donald Shoup's work about the high cost of free parking, decided to put one of his theories to the test.
If it works, it will make San Francisco an even better place to live and do business and visit. It'll just be yet another feather in the cap of San Francisco. And if it doesn't work, they can blame it all on a professor from Los Angeles.
LAUGHTER When we come back, we'll hear about that San Francisco parking experiment, and we'll hear about an incredibly common fraud that threatens to ruin just about any parking reform.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by GoToMeeting from Citrix, designed to be a fast and simple way to meet and collaborate online to get work done. GoToMeeting allows users to share screens, change presenters, and includes HD Faces video conferencing. GoToMeeting allows clients and coworkers to collaborate face-to-face and stay connected from wherever they are, using any computer or mobile device. Visit GoToMeeting.com. Click on the Try It Free button and enter promo code FREAK for a free 30-day trial. Freakonomics Radio is supported by LegalZoom, providing access to a network of attorneys for legal guidance through their legal plans available in most states. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but has been dedicated to the legal needs of individuals, families, and small businesses for more than 12 years, providing self-help services at user-specific direction. Information about wills, living trusts, incorporations, LLCs, trademarks, and legal plan attorneys at LegalZoom.com. Use the code FREAK for a special offer available to Freakonomics listeners.
It sort of feels like you're trapped. There's no way out. You know, when you get to a spot where you have to be and the parking is not happening, it's just a miserable experience. I drove around looking for a space that wasn't metered. It took me 25 minutes.
From WNYC and APM American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Michael Manville is an assistant professor of city and regional planning at Cornell University.
You know, cars are at their most useful to us when we're driving them, and that's when we think about them.
But we're not talking about driving today. We're talking about what happens to cars during the 95% of the time they're not being driven. We're talking about parking.
I think that a lot of transportation scholarship deals with driving the same way that everyday people do, which is just, you know, out of sight, out of mind. You know, once you're not in your car, you know, as long as you're pretty confident no one's going to break into it, like, who cares?
So we can agree that you are obsessed with the most boring part of car ownership, yes? Parking?
Yeah, that's probably a fair characterization.
Manville got his PhD at UCLA under parking guru Donald Shoup. And it is Shoup's research that recently inspired the city of San Francisco to try an experiment called SF Park. Here's Shoup again.
Well, it's a pilot project sponsored by the U.S. Department of Transportation to look at the effects of trying to get the price of parking right. It's easy to explain that they have sensors in the ground to measure the occupancy of each of 7,000 spaces, usually about 8 spaces on each block. And on blocks where they find a high occupancy, if they're all full, they nudge up the price. And on blocks where there are a lot of empty spaces, they nudge the prices down. They don't do it every day. They change the prices every 6 weeks. They have different prices at different times of the day, but before noon, from noon to 3, and then after 3 p.m. But those prices could be different on different blocks.
Changing prices like that, based on demand and time of day, is called dynamic pricing. And in some industries, it's been happening for years. Airline tickets, for instance. But for something like municipal parking, well, this is a pretty big deal. If you're a guy like Mike Manville, the city planning professor at Cornell who studied under Shoup, this is incredibly exciting.
So SF Park is probably the best experiment we have so far with the idea of sort of performance-priced curb parking. There's two components to the sort of dynamic part of the dynamic pricing, and one is that at different times of day, the prices are higher and lower. So at 9 a.m., the price might be $3, but at noon, when you expect a lot of people to be out and about for lunch, it might be $3.50, and then it might fall again by 4 p.m. back down to $3. So there's a price change that happens over the course of a day. The other part of it is that each month, SF Park evaluates overall occupancy and decides if the price on a particular block has to go up or down. So that same block face where the price was $3, then $3.50, then $3 over the course of a day in July might by September be $4, $4.50, and $3.25 or something like that.
So the idea is to capture the true price of parking for that area.
Yeah, you essentially establish a market in parking.
Scholars like Manville and Shoup argue that if you get the price of parking right, a lot of other problems get solved. Now, some drivers may have to pay more, but they can park where they want to park when they want, which is good for drivers and good for businesses. There'd be less cruising for parking spots, which means less congestion and pollution. But for dynamic priced parking to work, you do need people who are supposed to pay for the parking spots to actually pay for them. And as Mike Manville discovered, that doesn't always happen. He and a co-author ran a study of street parking in Los Angeles, which has the highest auto density of any American city. Manville and his team surveyed thousands of parking meters and found that, and I quote, "At any given time, almost 40% of vehicles parked at meters are both not paying and not breaking any laws." What?
There's three reasons why a vehicle could be sitting at a parking meter, not having paid, and not be breaking the law. And so the first one is simply that the meter's failed.
Okay.
The other one is government credentials. So that, you know, if you're...
My counterfeit FBI placard
exactly.
that I put in my car.
So, yeah. And, you know, a lot of places have actual rules that say, you know, if you're a cop or you work for a city council member in a particular car, you don't have to pay at
meters.
Or if
you've ever been married to someone who knew a cop, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm exaggerating, but we know that there are a lot of people who find a way to have a credential.
Yeah, find a way to get a credential. And even in places where it's actually not on the books that these people are exempt from meters, like informally, nobody tickets a police officer, right? So that's a share of non-payment as well, legal non-payment. And then the last one, and the big one, is disability credentials, particularly the disabled placards that are hung from the rearview mirror. At the time we did that study, and I think this has changed a little bit, there was about 25 states where if you had a disabled credential, you could just pull up to any metered space, park for free, and often for very long periods of time.
Okay. What share, roughly, are each of these? Is the handicapped the largest of them?
Yeah, far and away. The disabled placard really was the lion's share, and I think that it's useful to compare that category of non-payment with the sort of traditional scofflaw, you know, I'm just going to park and not pay. And it was twice that. You know, I think normally when we hear about cities losing meter revenue, we just think about, you know, bad enforcement and people aren't paying and nobody's busting them. But twice as many spaces were occupied by vehicles hanging disabled placards as by people who had just sort of chosen not to feed the meter.
Right. So you're saying in the paper that one of the reforms that would help solve this problem of wildly misused parking spaces is ending the practice of granting free time unlimited parking to vehicles displaying disabled placards. When you present a city or when a city learns of your research, do they say, oh, wow, Mike, thanks for solving this for me. Now we know why our parking is such a mess. All we got to do is get rid of all the handicap placards. Does that happen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, people just jump on board this right away. I mean, there's no elected official on earth who doesn't want to remove an entitlement that's at least nominally for a disadvantaged group so that they can charge everyone else more to park. I mean, it's just it's a killer idea. No, of course not. this is political kryptonite to a certain extent. And that is the issue.
Is it frustrating for you in that do you feel that you identified the problem to solve that would not fix parking by any stretch, but would certainly ease a significant strain on it? And yet, because you identified a problem that's politically not very savory, that it's probably not going to have much effect?
Well, I mean, in part, you know, sure, there's a little bit of frustration, but also that's life, right? I mean, if I really wanted to, you know, get into the trenches and everything, I wouldn't be an academic. So, right? I mean, so I do
feel
like...
It's nice to hear
someone
admit that, actually.
Yeah, there's people who change the world, and there's people who play with spreadsheets.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tend to fall in the latter camp.
Donald Shoup, maybe because he is the eminence grise of parking scholarship, aspires to both camps. He would really like to solve this implacable placard problem.
The placard abuse is just about everywhere, and everybody has a story or many stories about it. 22 UCLA football players were found with disabled placards. So a couple of states have done found a really clever way to get around this. Michigan had a lot of placard abuse, so they have a two-tier system of disabled placards. They revised the law and said that only people who have extreme trouble walking or can't use a meter because they have hand disabilities, only those people are eligible for a special placard that allows free parking at meters. The other people, they could use their disabled placards at disabled spots at grocery stores and things like that. Well, when this law came to effect, only 2% of the people with placards applied for the special placard, which required a doctor's visit and showing that you had a real disability that prevented walking. So it solved most of the disabled placard abuse problem. I think we should really support the 2%, the 2% who really need the free parking because they can't get to the meter. Illinois has copied this law, and I'm recommending it for California because there are blocks in Los Angeles. You could walk along. You see every single car at the meter has a disabled placard. So it doesn't make any difference what the price is. You know, it really undermines any attempt to manage parking.
The attempt to manage parking in San Francisco, SF Park, has been in place for more than a year. Prices move up and down at different times of the day and on different blocks according to demand. So, does SF Park work? That is, does it get the price of parking right? And if so, does that fix other problems? The short answer is, we don't know yet. It'll be a while before there's enough data to answer the questions we really want to know, like, do cars spend less time cruising for spots? Do buses run faster? Are pedestrians and bicyclists safer? Are businesses hurt or helped? One thing we do know for sure is how the parking prices changed. Some blocks got more expensive, others less. But the surprising thing, surprising at least to Donald Shoup, is that overall, the price of street parking fell.
Everybody expected prices to go through the roof. They said this is another money grab by the city. It's a tax on motorists as part of the war on cars. But it turned out not to be that way. A lot of the spaces were overpriced, and I think it's a good thing that the prices are lowered so that you get more customers for stores on the streets that have now lower prices. I think that's one of the big surprises. But it's true of any market. In real estate, they say, you know, it's location, location, location. The most convenient spaces are the ones you'd expect to have higher prices. And the less convenient ones are the ones you expect to have lower prices. And I think that what SF Park does is to get the price right in every location. I think we'll learn so much from this carefully controlled experiment that it should convince people that this is a good idea or not a good idea.
That's right. It may be that for all the care and logic put into an experiment like this, that something as seemingly simple as parking is hard to fix because of how people respond to incentives. It may be, for instance, that all those people who get hold of handicapped placards and other parking credentials take up so many of the good spots for free and for hours and hours and hours that smart parking will remain a dream. I asked Mike Manville what he's learned from watching the best parking ideas from academia get put into play in the real world.
So I think it probably teaches all of us who are academics that, you know, the real world's complicated and messy, that we come up with these ideas and they seem entirely valid to us. And I think it's very common for us as academics to sort of roll our eyes at policymakers and say, oh, why don't they just listen to us? And I think it's been very educational and occasionally humbling to watch ideas that I strongly believe in, you know, sort of get put into practice and see how difficult it is for the folks on the front lines to actually do them. So I think that it's been a real learning process in both directions.
And Donald Shoup, as energetic and optimistic as he is, acknowledges that when you try to change how people park, you're going up against a bigger enemy than a strip of asphalt. You're going up against biology.
Of course, Seinfeld always had episodes about hunting for parking. I think one of the quotes I like best from Seinfeld is when I think George and Elaine were driving to Jerry's apartment, and George said, I never pay for parking. Paying for parking is like going to a prostitute.
Why should I pay when if I apply myself, maybe I could get it for free?
And I think so many people are trying to get it for free. You know, we didn't become a great nation by being a bunch of freeloaders and expecting something for nothing. But when it comes to parking, I think, you know, our brains shift down to a lower level of intellectual performance. I think we use the reptilian cortex of our brains, uh-huh. You know, the earliest, most primitive part of the brain that makes fight or flight decisions or how to avoid being eaten or how to get food. And we would say things about parking that we would never say about something we really knew about.
Thanks to Donald Shoup, all of us at least know a little bit more about parking. But the future? That's harder to know. Parking might get worse or, for all kinds of reasons, might get better. The world keeps getting more urbanized, which means more people on foot, on bikes, and mass transit. Maybe car sharing will become more popular, which would lessen parking demand. And most exciting, to me at least, is the future of the driverless car. Now, some smart people think that in 10 or 20 years, most cars will be controlled by computers rather than accident-prone, Instagram-addicted, coffee-drinking, eyeliner-applying human beings. Now, if all cars were driverless, would you still need to own one? Or would you be willing to just summon one the way you now call a cab? It would come pick you up, then drop you off, and instead of having to park at the curb and wait for you, it could come pick me up or one of any other million people nearby. And then when you're done doing whatever you're doing, you summon a different car to come get you. How great would that be? And how much less parking would we need? Maybe a lot less. And then comes the really hard part. What do we do with those millions and millions and millions of parking spaces we've built all over the world? More nunneries, maybe? Hey there, would you like to be part of an upcoming episode of Freakonomics Radio? We are working on a podcast about names, and we want to hear from listeners and readers about their own names, common names, unusual names, everything in between. So we have set up a voicemail line at 646-829-4478. Give us a call, tell us your full name, and then tell us a little bit about your first name, how you got it, what it means. Again, that number is 646-829-4478. And here's another way you can play along with Freakonomics. Here's Steve Levitt.
If you want to be more than just a listener, but a part of the Freakonomics research team, go to freakonomicsexperiments.com. If you haven't been there yet, we will help you decide the biggest decisions in your life using a coin toss. And I think you'll have some fun along the way as well. Freakonomicsexperiments.com.
Freakonomics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. This episode was produced by Catherine Wells with help from Diana Wynn. Our staff includes Susie Lechtenberg, David Herman, Beret Lamb, and Chris Bannon. Colin Campbell is our executive producer. If you want more Freakonomics Radio, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or go to Freakonomics.com, where you'll find lots of radio, a blog, the books, and more.
Chris Anderson asked me if I could put the last 25 years of anti-poverty campaigning into 10 minutes for TED. That's an Englishman asking an Irishman to be succinct. I said, Chris, that would take a miracle. He said, Bono, wouldn't that be a good use of your messianic complex? So, yeah. Then I thought, let's go even further. Let's go then 25 years. Let's go back before Christ, 3 millennia, to a time when, at least in my head, the journey for justice, the march against inequality and poverty really began. 3,000 years ago, civilization just getting started on the banks of the Nile. Some slaves, Jewish shepherds in this instance, smelling of sheep shit, I guess, proclaim to the Pharaoh, sitting high on his throne, "We, your majestiness, are equal to you." And the Pharaoh replies, "Oh no, you, your miserableness, have got to be kidding." And they say, no, that's what it says here in our holy book. Cut to our century, same country, same pyramids, another people spreading the same idea of equality with a different book. This time it's called The Facebook. Crowds are gathered in Tahrir Square. They turn a social network from virtual to actual and kind of rebooted the 21st century. Not to undersell how messy and ugly the aftermath of the Arab Spring has been, neither to oversell the role of technology, but these things have given a sense of what's possible when the age-old model of power, the pyramid, gets turned upside down, putting the people on top and the pharaohs of today on the bottom, as it were. It's also shown us that something as powerful as information and the sharing of it can challenge inequality, because facts, like people, want to be free. And when they're free, liberty is usually around the corner, even for the poorest of the poor. Facts that can challenge cynicism and the apathy that leads to inertia. Facts that tell us what's working and, more importantly, what's not, so we can fix it. Facts that, if we hear them and heed them, could help us meet the challenge that Nelson Mandela made back in 2005 when he asked us to be that great generation that overcomes that most awful offense to humanity, extreme poverty. Facts that build a powerful momentum. So I thought, forget the rock opera, forget the bombast, my usual tricks. The only thing singing today would be the facts, for I have truly embraced my inner nerd. So exit the rock star, enter the evidence-based activist, the factivist. And what because what the facts are telling us is that the long, slow journey, humanity's long, slow journey of equality, is actually speeding up. Look at what's been achieved. Look at the pictures these data sets print. Since the year 2000, since the turn of the millennium, there are 8 million more AIDS patients getting life-saving antiretroviral drugs. Malaria, there are 8 countries in sub-Saharan Africa that have their death rates cut by 75%. For kids under 5, child mortality, kids under 5, it's down by 2.65 million a year. That's a rate of 7,256 children's lives saved each day. Wow. Wow. Let's just stop for a second, actually, and think about that. Have you read anything anywhere in the last week that is remotely as important as that number? Wow. Great news. It drives me nuts that most people don't seem to know this news. 7,000 kids a day. Here's two of them. This is Michael and Benedicta. And they're alive, thanks in large part to Dr. Patricia Asamoah. She's amazing. And the Global Fund, which all of you financially support, whether you know it or not. And the Global Fund provides antiretroviral drugs that stop mothers from passing HIV to their kids. This fantastic news didn't happen by itself. It was fought for, it was campaigned for, it was innovated for. And this great news gives birth to even more great news. Because the historic trend is this. The number of people living in back-breaking, soul-crushing extreme poverty has declined from 43% of the world's population in 1990 to 33% by 2000, and then to 21% by 2010. Give it up for that. Halved. Now, the rate is still too high, still too many people unnecessarily losing their lives. There's still work to do, but it's heart-stopping. It's mind-blowing stuff. And if you live on less than $1.25 a day, if you live in that kind of poverty, this is not just data. This is everything. If you're a parent who wants the best for your kids, and I am, this rapid transition is a route out of despair and into hope. And guess what? If the trajectory continues, look where the amount of people living on $1.25 a day gets to by 2030. Can't be true, can it? That's what the data is telling us. If the trajectory continues, we get to, wow, the zero zone. For number crunchers like us, that is the erogenous zone. And it's fair to say that I am by now sexually aroused by the collating of data. So, virtual elimination of extreme poverty, as defined by people living on less than $1.25 a day, adjusted, of course, for inflation from a 1990 baseline. We do live a good baseline. That's amazing. Now, I know that some of you think this progress is all in Asia or Latin America or model countries like Brazil, and who doesn't love a Brazilian model? But look at sub-Saharan Africa. There's a collection of 10 countries, some call them the Lions, who in the last decade have had a combination of 100% debt cancellation, a tripling of aid, a tenfold increase in FDI, that's foreign direct investment, which has unlocked a quadrupling of domestic resources, that's local money, which when spent wisely, that's good governance, cut childhood mortality by a third, doubled education completion rates, and they too halved extreme poverty. And at this rate, these 10 get to 0-2. So the pride of lions is the proof of concept. There are all kinds of benefits to this. For a start, you won't have to listen to an insufferable little jumped-up Jesus like myself. How about that? And 2028, 2030, it's just around the corner. I mean, it's about 3 Rolling Stones farewell concerts away. I hope. I'm hoping. Makes us look really young. So why aren't we jumping up and down about this? Well, the opportunity is real, but so is the jeopardy. We can't get this done until we really accept that we can get this done. Look at this graph. It's called inertia. It's how we screw it up. And the next one is really beautiful. It's called momentum. And it's how we can bend the arc of history down towards zero, just doing the things that we know work. So inertia versus momentum, there is jeopardy. And of course, the closer you get, it gets harder. We know the obstacles that are in our way right now in difficult times. In fact, today in your capital. In difficult times, some who mind the nation's purse want to cut life-saving programs like the Global Fund. But you can do something about that. You can tell politicians that these cuts can't cause lives. Right now, today in Oslo, as it happens, oil companies are fighting to keep secret their payments to governments for extracting oil in developing countries. You can do something about that too. You can join the One Campaign, and leaders like Mo Ibrahim, the telecom entrepreneur, were pushing for laws that make sure that at least some of the wealth under the ground ends up in the hands of the people living above it. And right now, we know that the biggest disease of all is not a disease. It's corruption. But there's a vaccine for that too. It's called transparency, open data sets. Something the TED community is really on it. Daylight, you could call it. Transparency. And technology is really turbocharging this. It's getting harder to hide if you're doing bad stuff. So let me tell you about the U Report. So I'm really excited about it. It's 150,000 millennials all across Uganda, young people armed with 2G phones, an SMS social network exposing government corruption and demanding to know what's in the budget and how their money is being spent. This is exciting stuff. Look, once you have these tools, you can't not use them. Once you have this knowledge, you can't unknow it. You can't delete this data from your brain, but you can delete the cliched image of supplicant, impoverished peoples not taking control of their own lives. You can erase that. You really can, because it's not true anymore. It's transformational. 2030? By 2030, robots? Not just serving us Guinness, but drinking it? By the time we get there, every place with a rough semblance of governance might actually be, you know, on their way. So I'm here to, we're here to try and infect you with this virtuous data-based virus, the one we call factivism. It's not going to kill you. In fact, it could save countless lives. I guess we in the One Campaign would love you to be contagious, spread it, share it, pass it on. By doing so, you will join us and countless others in what I truly believe is the greatest adventure ever taken, the ever-demanding journey of equality. Could we really be the great generation that Mandela asked us to be? Might we answer that clarion call with science, with reason, with facts, and dare I say it, emotions? Because, as is obvious, factivists have feelings too. I'm thinking of Wael Gonen, though. Some of you know him. He set up one of the Facebook groups behind the Tahrir Square in Cairo. He got thrown in jail for it, but I have his words tattooed on my brain. We are going to win because we don't understand politics. We are going to win because we don't play their dirty games. We are going to win because we don't have a party political agenda. We are going to win because the tears that come from our eyes actually come from our hearts. We're going to win because we have dreams, and we're willing to stand up for those dreams. Wael is right. We're going to win if we work together as one, because the power of the people is so much stronger than the people in power. Thank you. Thank you so much.
So this book that I have in my hand is a directory of everybody who had an email address in 1982. to get a message anywhere was to send it to this guy, who would send it back in time and get it there super early. So every message in the internet started getting switched through this one node, and of course that clogged everything up, everything started breaking. The interesting thing was, though, that the sysadmins were able to fix it, but they had to basically turn every single thing on the internet off. Now, of course, you couldn't do that today. I mean, everything off. It's like, you know, the service call you get from the cable company, except for the whole world. Now, in fact, they couldn't do it for a lot of reasons today. One of the reasons is a lot of their telephones use IP protocol and use things like Skype and so on that go through the internet right now. And so, in fact, we're becoming dependent on it for more and more different things. Like, when you take off from LAX, you're really not thinking you're using the internet. When you pump gas, you really don't think you're using the internet. And what's happening increasingly, though, is these systems are beginning to use the internet. Most of them aren't based on the internet yet, but they're starting to use the internet for service functions, for administrative functions. And so if you take something like the cell phone system, which is still relatively independent of the internet for the most part, its internet pieces are beginning to sneak into it in terms of some of the control and administrative functions. And it's so tempting to use these same building blocks because they work so well, they're cheap, they're repeated, and so on. So all of our systems more and more are starting to use the same technology and starting to depend on this technology. And so even a modern rocket ship these days actually uses internet protocol to talk from one end of the rocket ship to the other. And that's crazy. It was never designed to do things like that. So we've built this system where we understand all the parts of it, but we're using it in a very, very different way than we expected to use it. And it's gotten a very, very different scale than it was designed for. And in fact, nobody really exactly understands all the things it's being used for right now. It's turning into one of these big emergent systems like the financial system, where we've designed all the parts, but nobody really exactly understands how it operates and all the little details of it and what kinds of emergent behaviors it can have. And so if you hear an expert talking about the internet and saying it can do this, or it does do this, or it will do that, you should treat it with the same skepticism that you might treat the comments of an economist about the economy or a weatherman about the weather or something like that. They have an informed opinion, but it's changing so quickly that even the experts don't know exactly what's going on. So if you see one of these maps of the internet, it's just somebody's guess. Nobody really knows what the internet is right now because it's different than it was an hour ago. It's constantly changing, it's constantly reconfiguring. And the problem with it is, I think we're setting ourselves up for a kind of disaster like the disaster we had in the financial system, where we take a system that's basically built on trust, was basically built for a smaller scale system, and we've kind of expanded it way beyond the limits of how it was meant to operate. And so right now, I think it's literally true that we don't know what the consequences of an effective denial of service attack on the internet would be. And whatever it would be, it's going to be worse next year and worse next year and so on. So what we need is a plan B. There is no plan B right now. There's no clear backup system that we've very carefully kept to be independent of the internet, made out of completely different sets of building blocks. So what we need is something that doesn't necessarily have to have the performance of the internet, but the police department has to be able to call up the fire department even without the internet, or the hospitals have to order fuel oil. This doesn't need to be a multi-billion dollar government project. It's actually relatively simple to do technically because it can use existing fibers that are in the ground, existing wireless infrastructure. It's basically a matter of deciding to do it. But people won't decide to do it until they kind of recognize the need for it. And that's the problem that we have right now. So there've been plenty of us have been quietly kind of arguing that we should have this independent system for years. But it's very hard to get people focused on Plan B when Plan A seems to be working so well. So I think that if people understand how much that we're starting to depend on the internet and how vulnerable it is, we could get focused on just wanting this other system to exist. And I think if enough people say, yeah, I would like to use it, I'd like to have such a system, then it will get built. It's not that hard a problem. It could definitely be done by people in this room. And so I think that this is actually, all the problems you're going to hear about at the conference, this is probably one of the very easiest to fix. So I'm happy to get a chance to tell you about it. Thank you very much.
If you want to change the world, then you have to change yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford Community College. Henry Ford Community College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford Community College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford Community College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford Community College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
Taylor, WHF.
I'm trying to use the phone!
Hey, loyal listener, call WHFR at 313-845-9676 or toll free at 1-800-585-HFCC, extension 9676.
What? I couldn't hear that last part.
That's 845-9676 or toll free 1-800-585-HFCC, extension 9676.
You ready?
Yes, sir!
We are PAC 547.
We are PAC 547!
From Redford, Michigan.
From Redford, Michigan!
We are proud of our city.
We are proud of our city!